On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Carol Tavris discusses her book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, and its implications for the skeptical community.
Of course, there are many people who pride themselves on being skeptics who aren't skeptical about the things they believe in. We are all of us inclined to read disconfirming research more critically than confirming research. There's actually been research on this.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. And before we jump into today's interview, I wanted to update you on some of the things that have been going on here at Skeptico. We really have quite a bit happening. And for those of you who are regular listeners, I know that you're interested in the research projects that we have going on, and I do receive a bunch of emails about that. So I wanted to update you. So first, the Dogs That Know research that we started about a year ago, I want you all to know that that is kind of throttling along. I'm in contact with the folks at the University of Florida Canine Cognition Lab on a regular basis. We've tested a couple of dogs and probably haven't found quite the right dog yet, but it takes a lot more time and effort than I think you could imagine. They've been fantastic, and we're definitely pursuing that research. They're pursuing that research, and I'm very optimistic that the preliminary results that we've seen will be confirmed later in that research. Next is the Medium Demonstration Project, and several of you picked up on the fact that I recently issued a press release asking for participants for this research, and I received quite a few participants and did a little preliminary testing on my own to kind of work out the protocol. We changed the protocol slightly in a way that I think skeptics are going to be very, very happy with. It's a very minimalistic protocol in terms of the amount of information that goes on between the medium and the person requesting the reading. As a matter of fact, they never even talk. And in my preliminary test, the results have been quite significant, quite amazing. So you'll hear a lot more about that in the upcoming weeks and months as we're about ready to reconnect with the folks at the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and see if they are still willing to go forward with this research and find a way to do that. I'd also like to consider moving that into a university setting as well, because I think that's where all this research really belongs, and that's really the goal of Skeptico, is to incubate real scientific research into these controversial areas. Which brings us to the third research project that we've started and have initiated, and that's with psychic detectives. And of course, Ben Radford and I are looking for a case that we can investigate together, and I think we're close to finding that. Ben, I think, is on board with that, and I'm trying to make sure that I have access to the information that I need to do a good job of investigating whatever case we decide as well. In addition to that, Noreen Rainier has agreed to take part in a university-sponsored research project to test the efficacy of the kind of information that psychic detectives generate. That's in the very early stages, obviously, but stay tuned, and we hope to get that research initiative going as well. So a lot of things going on, and it's really going in the direction that I'd like to see it going, which is collaborative research that puts these questions to the scientific test and does it in a way that addresses the legitimate skeptical concerns going in. But now let's move on to today's interview. I still try and stay tuned to a lot of the skeptical broadcasts that are out there, even though they're sometimes a little bit difficult to listen to, as it is hard to listen to people that you usually don't agree with. But our guest today, Dr. Carol Tavris, appeared on a number of these skeptical shows. Even though she's a very mainstream psychologist, she has aligned herself with several of the skeptical groups and has been out talking up her book, which is really a very mainstream book about cognitive dissonance. And I couldn't help in listening to these interviews how all of her principles apply so much to the skeptical community and their blind spots in looking at real research that disconfirms their worldview. So I thought she'd be a great guest to have on, and I think we had a pretty interesting dialogue. Here's my interview with Dr. Carol Tavris. We're joined today by Dr. Carol Tavris, who along with Dr. Elliot Aronson is the author of Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts, which is a wonderful book title and one that really gets to the heart of what the book's about, and that is the theory of cognitive dissonance. So, Dr. Tavris, I thought we'd start with a little background on you, maybe some talk about your training, and particularly what sparked your interest in dissonance theory.
Well, I have a PhD in social psychology and a very quirky career as a social psychologist, lecturer, writer. My interest right along from the beginning was in translating psychological science for the public interest and to persuade the public that psychological science is not an oxymoron. This is an uphill battle in today's culture, I don't have to tell you. And so, but it's been a very interesting career because I love science, I love psychological research. And in our culture, we've had such a huge gap between pop psych nonsensical notions and the really good and useful work that good psychological science can provide. And in an effect, that's what my work has been in my whole career. So my very first book, which was on anger, was an examination of many myths and misconceptions about anger that had been perpetuated by the Freudian and other psychoanalytic establishment in our culture to show, you know, no, many of those assumptions were wrong. So that's what I love to do. And over the years, I have discovered an extremely interesting thing, which is that when you present people with wonderful, good scientific data showing them that they might actually be wrong about some belief that they hold dear, they don't say, "Oh, thank you so much for giving me this fabulous information. I will change my mind immediately and move on to a better way of life." No. They tell you what you can do with your data, you know?
Right.
So my interest, you asked, you know, what sparked my interest in dissonance theory. My interest has been in mistaken ideas and the harm that they can cause, as in recovered memory therapy or therapeutic fads that have been more harmful than helpful and so on. And I was sitting with my very old friend, Elliot Aronson, one day, and we got to talking about why it was that George Bush was unable to say, even with a whole country calling on him to say so, "I was wrong about weapons of mass destruction. I was wrong that the war in Iraq would be over in 6 weeks. I was wrong that it was not going to cost us anything. I was wrong about the consequences of our involvement there. And because I was wrong, I did the best thing with the information I had at the time, but I was wrong, and now let's rethink this whole adventure." Commentators on the left and right were urging Bush to speak straight to the country, and he didn't do it. Now, Elliot is one of the country's, the world's greatest social psychologists, and he had been studying dissonance theory for many years, starting when he was a graduate student working with his mentor and advisor at Stanford, Leon Festinger, who developed the theory of cognitive dissonance. What Elliot did was transform that theory into one of self-justification, and as we got to talk, we realized that his life work on self-justification and my interest in the social uses of psychological science and how it is that people don't respond more openly to information that would be beneficial made a nice match. And so we put our interests together in deciding that we would write this book.
Well, great. It's interesting the path that you trace there because it's has some interesting crossroads with me here. I have to say, I have to thank my wife, Dr. Joni Johnston, who is a psychologist and an author, for giving me your book, as well as for a lot of other things.
I thank her,
course.
Too.
But also for a long time ago, exposing me to the work of Leon Festinger and the book When Prophecy Fails, which I think has become somewhat of a touchstone for her and I. And I found it just fascinating when you recap that research in your beginning of your book. So I thought maybe you'd want to share with people a little bit about what he found, because I think it's obviously very relevant to what you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Oh, When Prophecy Fails was indeed a wonderful and interesting book. Festinger and his colleagues infiltrated a little band of believers who predicted that the world would come to an end on December 21st. And it was the first field study of the theory of cognitive dissonance that Festinger was developing. So the question was, assuming that the world did not in fact end on December 21st, what would these people do? How would they reconcile their attachment to this group and their belief that the world would end with the evidence that it did not? And what he found was, and this is the heart of dissonance theory, it's why it's not such an obvious way of understanding how the mind works. What he found was that the more that people invest in an idea, the more committed they are to it, the more the time, money, effort, and public displays of commitment to the belief that they've done, the harder it is going to be for them to say, boy, what a fool I was, boy, was I wrong. And so indeed, in this little group of true believers, the ones who waited for the end of the world quietly in their own homes and the world didn't end, I mean, that was no problem. Okay, I believed that for a month. It didn't happen, so no problem.
Right.
But the ones who sat there with the woman he called Mrs. Keach, the leader of the group, who had sold their homes, who had given up their jobs, who were waiting to be whisked away in a spaceship to be rescued and so forth, what were they going to do? And what he found was, they became even stronger in their belief. You know, in the middle of the night, Mrs. Keach had a vision that her commitment to the prophecy had saved the world. And now, you know, right. Okay, it was a fabulous way of resolving the dissonance. Now, why this is important, what Festinger found is that cognitive dissonance is the uncomfortable feeling we have when two ideas conflict with each other. Now, for him, this was a very cognitive theory. I smoke. I know smoking can kill me. This is uncomfortable. I have to resolve this dissonance in one of two ways. I quit smoking or I justify smoking. Now, that's true. Of course, the other great contribution of dissonance theory was to show that before we make a decision, we are all extremely open-minded. We get information about both choices. After we make a decision, the mind shuts. And now we will justify the decision that we made. Because information about the choice we didn't make, the car we didn't buy, the house we didn't buy, the spouse we didn't choose, any information suggesting we were wrong in the decision we made is dissonant. It's uncomfortable. And the key thing about Festinger's theory is it's motivating. It's as uncomfortable as extreme hunger. We don't like walking around in a state of dissonance. And so to reduce it, we will stop considering information suggesting we made the wrong choice, and we will start paying attention only to information supporting the decision we made. Now, you can see why this is basically a good thing. Evolutionarily speaking, it allows us to sleep at night and not beat ourselves up over roads we didn't take. And in fact, we all know people who can't reduce dissonance quickly enough, and they suffer for it, right? They keep hitting themselves upside the head saying, why didn't I? Why didn't I? Okay. Well, you don't want to live your life that way either. But you can see how in science, in personal decisions, in professional choices, if we in fact shut our minds to dissonant information, information showing that we made the wrong choice or that we might be on the wrong path, well then, how are we ever going to get off it? And what Eliot did that advanced this theory so profoundly was to say, dissonance is greatest when an element of the self-concept is involved. Not when it's just any two cognitions, but when it's I'm a smart, good, competent person. You've just given me information that I did something stupid, foolish, harmful, or wrong. What do I do? Change my view of myself or dismiss the evidence that you're giving me?
You know, the other part of that that I found fascinating, and I think the book does a very good job of exploring, is the process. I love the concept of the pyramid. So, you know, it's easy to look at these extreme examples and say, isn't that a great case of how people can really get their beliefs twisted around? But I think the pyramid that you describe is, it really brings home how we can get to that point. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Thank you. I find that pyramid enormously helpful as a way of understanding so many of the polarized stances that people end up with, because we assume that it's because they have opposite views that they have always had. I mean, look at the therapists who supported or don't support recovered memory therapy. This war has continued now for some 20 years. But of course, it didn't begin that way. The metaphor of the pyramid works like this. You take two people who are at the top of a pyramid. They're side by side. They're a millimeter apart. They have the same kind of attitude, let's say, about cheating or whatever the subject is. They don't think it's a horrible thing. They don't think it's a good thing. They're kind of neutral about it. This was actually an experiment that was done with school children. And now you give people an opportunity to cheat. And one cheats and one doesn't cheat. What now happens is that each one will justify their behavior to make their behavior consonant with their attitudes. So the one who cheats begins to justify cheating. Well, cheating isn't really such a bad thing, and besides, I really needed this grade, and besides, everybody does it, and it's no big deal, and so on, so okay. The one who didn't cheat will decide that cheating is really a serious matter after all. It's not a victimless crime. Everybody suffers as a result of this. This is not a good thing to do, and so forth. And over time, each one will move further away from the other, down the two sides of a pyramid, until they are standing at the base of the pyramid miles apart. These two people who were once very alike. And each one will think that their views about cheating are the way they have always believed. They will internalize these new beliefs, and they will have pretty much blinded themselves to understanding how the other person sees this problem. And
it's amazing because it, in some ways, it really explains the phenomena that we all experience so much, which is where how two groups that seem to be aligned in their interest and in their motivation for knowledge wind up to be the most polarized on a particular topic. You know, they know it so well, and they've walked down the pyramid. And I think that offers an explanation for why there's such a disagreement between, let's say, Protestants or Catholics, or in the psychology example you talked about in the recovered memory. You know, these are groups that share a lot of the same information to, as a starting point, and wind up extremely polarized at the end.
Exactly right. It's because I mean, these are normal biases of the brain. We understand now from cognitive science that this is in fact how the brain works to make our lives easier, if you will. So that one of the things that happens is not only do we look for reasons to justify the decision we made, but because of the confirmation bias, I'm sure you've talked about this on your show before, the confirmation bias is the universal bias we all have of noticing and remembering information that confirms what we believe, and ignoring, minimizing, trivializing, and forgetting information that disconfirms what we believe. Of course, the essence of science is to be open to disconfirming evidence, but that's not a natural habit of the human mind. So if you put together the need to justify decisions we've made with the confirmation bias, which keeps us seeing only the evidence that we were right about the decision we made, then you can see further how people might end up in polarized positions and be unable to move back up that pyramid and say, you know what, I was wrong about this. Because, as Eliot puts it, if you pride yourself on your professionalism, on your skill as a therapist, on your being a good guy as a prosecutor, on your brilliance as a surgeon, on your political acumen, if these are important sources of self-esteem and pride for you to feel competent and smart, as is the case for just about all of us, then how much more difficult is it to learn that you, a prosecutor, has put an innocent guy in prison, that you, a therapist, have been practicing a form of therapy that might really have destroyed your clients and your client's family, that you, a doctor, have just cut off the wrong arm of your patient. You know, these are profoundly dissonant shocks to the system.
Right. And as you were just talking there, I think you, as you do in the book, do a really nice job of expanding this theory into many areas, into politics, religion, and even personal relationships. But I want to bring it back to science for a minute, because I think it really has particularly strong impact in terms of how we look at science, because this is obviously an area where we've tried very hard to avoid these kind of biases and trying to create a system that prevents us from falling into these critical thinking potholes, if you will. So as I read your book and I listened to a couple of the interviews, I was alternatively, you know, inspired and just irritated as well, you know. So, for example, I listened to your interview on the podcast for the Skeptical Inquirer, and I was listening to you talking to an audience of skeptics, and it was just so ironic to me because, number one, you know, PsyCop, now CSI, is not exactly a group that sought out a diversity of opinion or sponsored any collaborative research. And number two, as I've explored in the show over the last couple of years, this kind of self-justifying, you know, defend the status quo is exactly what I've found as I've attempted to bridge the gap between skeptics and controversial science. So I wanted to delve into the skeptical part of it a little bit. And I don't know, you know, how you became aligned with these groups or whether you even consider yourself a skeptic. I mean, is that a title that you hold okay with, or?
Oh, that's a very good question. Do I consider myself a skeptic? I want to think about this for a moment. What's the question?
Yeah, let me be clear, because I think these terms get thrown around and they lose their meaning. We can make it real easy. I mean, if you pick up the Skeptical Inquirer magazine, the position they take week after week or month after month, I think it's a monthly publication, is a position that is the skeptical position. So you're a fellow for CSI. You've been aligned with a lot of those folks. Do you consider yourself a skeptic in that vein?
Okay, this is a very fine question, and I'd not thought of it before this way. So I would say this. I'm a skeptical person, but I am not a skeptic. No one has ever asked me this before, okay? I don't feel that I am a skeptic as an identity. I like to see myself as a person who, I have many passionate beliefs, personal, political, scientific beliefs. The goal for me as a psychologist in my textbooks with Carol Wade, for example, our psychology textbooks were among the first to talk about critical thinking as a way of doing psychology, that the findings of psychology are going to change from year to year, edition to edition. But if you can understand what it means to be a critical thinker, then that's the skill we want you to take with you when you leave this course, meaning that you look for the evidence for certain claims, that you don't just accept somebody's claim because it's said by an authority or a famous person or someone who's cute, that you keep an open mind if better evidence comes along to cause you to revise your beliefs, that you're willing to consider other explanations for something that you hold dear, that you have convictions, that you have beliefs that guide your life, but you hold them lightly enough so that if you need to change them when better evidence comes along, you can. I would say that is my guiding philosophy. What that means, though, is I'm skeptical, of course, about a lot of the claims that people make in our country, pop health claims that people make all the time without evidence. So Let's separate the goal of being able to be skeptical about so many of the kinds of claims that people make in our culture that are anti-scientific or unscientific, to debunk the psychics and mystics and people who prey on.
But wait a minute, because you started there with something that I agree with, but it's very, very hard to do. And then we were wandering into another territory. I'll give you just a small example of something that I've talked about on this show before, and it has to do with Michael Shermer, who is a very smart, very capable person, excellent writer, and I enjoy listening to. But this example kind of brings the point to a certain clarity and focus that we can talk about. So, and it's rather brief, but it takes a little while to go into it. So in 2001, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's this Dutch researcher named Pim van Lommel, and he publishes this very extensive multi-year study on near-death experience. And it's very well received. It's published in The Lancet, you know, one of the top medical journals in the world. So it's obviously extremely well thought of it to be published in peer review there. But the problem is, this study suggests that near-death experience can't be explained by conventional neurology, and it kind of points to survival of consciousness after death as a very real possibility. So here's the cognitive dissonance part. Michael Shermer, again, who's a smart guy, you know, doesn't make mistakes, writes his column in Scientific America, but he cites the study as evidence against near-death experience. Now, this so upsets, you know, the original researcher that he publicly makes a rebuttal and says, hey, this guy totally got it wrong. And what's the upshot? Shermer never backs down. Shermer never admits that he was wrong. He never admits that the studies, you know, did say the opposite. And without saying, you know, obviously I'm probably exposing you to information here that's somewhat new to you. But I think that what I've found over and over again is this need to the starting point that you did, to say, hey, we all need to be open-minded, disconfirming information, and then you go into the psychic thing. Well, what is the best evidence that we have of psychic research? Well, it was done by Dr. Julie Beischel at the University of Arizona, and we're now working on replicating that study. But it's published and peer-reviewed, you know, so we can talk about it. It's all, the lens has to be very carefully focused when we talk about skepticism and what we need to be skeptical of.
Yes. Yes. Okay, well, first of all, I don't want to weigh in on any issue or argument or debate that I haven't been following and I don't know anything about. Second, though, what I would say is all of us, everybody, without fail, is going to be closed-minded about something. Of course, there are many people who pride themselves on being skeptics who aren't skeptical about the things they believe in. I'm not talking about Michael in this particular case, but everybody, whatever the particular issue is, that's something that they care about. We are all of us inclined to read research too. I mean, scientists do this as well, to read disconfirming research more critically than confirming research. There's actually been research on this. Okay.
Right.
Which is, I mean, it's really a funny thing. You know, we look at studies, if you believe that men and women have, you know, important biological differences in the brain, you know, you look at research one way and disconfirming research another way. And I mean, that's, you know, so nobody is a pure open-minded thinker, okay? And so the goal in our book is not to call anybody names or to say that somebody does something better than others, but to point to the ways in which we all feel dissonance when something that we believe is so, suddenly there's disconfirming evidence. That's what it means to be in a state of dissonance. Whatever the belief is, that there is a near-death experience or that there isn't, or that there's psychic powers or that they're not, nobody is happy with disconfirming evidence. So the task then becomes, how do we assess information in a way that allows us to move the conversation forward in a thoughtful and useful way? One of our concerns in our book is that it's hard enough for people to do this when they don't have vested interests in the outcome of research. But the big change in our society now, where so much research is funded by corporate interests who have a financial stake in the results of the studies, right, this has a way of tainting the research that people do without realizing it, because people see themselves as good, independent, scientific, critical thinkers, and don't even want to entertain the possibility that they're being biased by the people who are funding them.
Well, I think,
but there are also intellectual vested interests, of course, in an idea.
Right. So, I mean, there's we've taken the idea of science being value free, and we can one throw that out the window because as our as we socially become more and more polarized on our views, it's clear that we're not value free in our science, and then we add the corporate element to it, and we're financially not value-free either. So it's a tough situation. I think you make a wonderful contribution in terms of prescribing a way to navigate that. But in talking about, let's talk about how you think groups that have different beliefs can create a dialogue and how they can come together. Because in some respects, you don't paint a very optimistic picture for changing people's minds, especially if their beliefs are firmly entrenched.
That's true. Because of this, for example, I mean, one of the conclusions that we make in talking about the legal system is that because so many prosecutors, police, once they have been sliding down the pyramid for a long time to put someone in prison, seeing themselves as the good guys all the way along, it's extremely difficult for a district attorney to look at evidence, DNA evidence, say, that they've put in, that the guy they put in prison is in fact innocent. So as we show in the book, it has often taken an independent commission, outside parties, a new district attorney coming in to relook at these cases and make sure that justice prevails. Mm-hmm. That's what Morgenthau did in the case of the Central Park jogger case. They put five innocent kids in prison for years until the real rapist attacker confessed. And when they then went back and looked at the actual evidence against those kids had been put away during a time of hysteria and craziness, as often happens when there's a terrible miscarriage of justice or a rape and a murder and so forth. The public opinion runs very passionate, and district attorneys are under the gun to get somebody and, you know, put them away. So in that case, it precisely because it is so difficult for a professional to stand up on his or her hind feet and say, I was wrong, and by God, I'm going to fix this. That is why we need to have correcting mechanisms in place, whether it's videotaping of interviews and other precautions and independent commissions. Sometimes these solutions can only be institutional. That said, I mean, in many institutions, at an individual level, it's possible indeed for individuals, once they understand the mechanism of dissonance and to feel how it works in themselves and in their partners and loved ones, to make changes. It has been so interesting for Elliot and for me, the letters that we have gotten from people saying, whoa, I read this, it was like looking into a mirror. But now one of the things that happens is that you become very aware of how dissonance works. So what that means is that if you want, for example, to explain to another person, like your beloved, why you're right and the beloved is wrong, one of the things you don't say is, what were you thinking when you did that? What is the matter with you that you can't possibly see how wrong you are, okay? Because you understand that that kind of language is going to put them right smack in dissonance. They're going to say, what was I thinking? What I was thinking was that I'm right, of course, and that I'm the smart person here. They're going to feel defensive. They're going to want to protect the decision that they made. When we understand what dissonance feels like and the mental effort we put into reducing it, it becomes easier to break that habit. As Elliot says, it makes us more mindful, and in that mindfulness is the possibility of change. So as he says, for example, if you know that after you buy a car, you're going to be feeling dissonance about the car you didn't get and a little worried about the car you did get, you know what to expect. You know what it feels like, and you know to be careful about not cutting off information that could be helpful to you in the future. That's a small example, a car, but of course it applies to big decisions as well. It's a very useful thing to understand, both in managing our own post-decision dissonance, our own intellectual dissonance, and our own personal dissonance with our loved ones.
I can certainly see in the personal realm how that tactful approach can yield much better results than otherwise. But I do question whether or not we should or can always be that way when it comes to science. I mean, for example, you know, is that it almost sounds a little bit politically correct kind of speak, and I wonder if we can't be more direct sometimes. For example, and I mentioned this in my email to you, and you just mentioned it earlier, but in your book you talk about Sigmund Freud, who is a guy who has now been so thoroughly discredited that if he were a modern-day scholar, he'd certainly be facing civic, if not criminal, charges, and would be a complete academic pariah, right? So how are we supposed to treat him? In your book, you do a balancing act, I feel like. You know, on one hand, you're mentioning that, hey, a lot of these theories don't work out so well. But on the other hand, you don't go all the way in terms of truth-telling that I think a lot of people still don't know just how exposed his research and his deception was. So what about this need for truth-telling? And how do we draw the line on when we're maybe being a little bit too direct and we need to be a little bit more tactful, and when we really need to stand up and say, wait, this is the way things are, and here are the facts that I'm basing that on, and I'm willing to withstand whatever blowback I get from that?
Well, first of all, boy, I thought we were plenty strong. Well, we weren't talking about Freud. We were talking about Freudian ideas that have bubbled up in two ways. One was the completely unscientific way that Freud proceeded. Here's something I believe. Everything I see confirms what I believe. Everything you tell me that you don't think that I'm right is just evidence that you're not seeing what I see, and that just shows what a bad perceiver you are. I mean, there was nobody less scientific in that respect than Freud, which I thought we were pretty clear about.
You were. No, to be fair, you were. But, I mean, to go one step further, I mean, it's now been revealed that that the way he went about promoting those ideas was to fake.
Oh, yeah, he's a self-promoter and so forth.
But he faked the data, right? I mean, he generated case studies that were completely fictitious. And as a matter of fact, his patients are getting ready to leave him and are saying none of this stuff is working. And he turns around and writes these case studies that I've cured these people and all these other things. I mean, that is completely.
That's a lie.
Yeah, that's a lie. And imagine that from a modern-day scholar. It wouldn't be, well, he still had some interesting contributions, although these theories didn't work out. It would be, no, we need to really put this person aside and hold them up as exactly the opposite of how science is supposed to work.
Right. Okay, well, I think there might be a couple of issues that you're raising here. First of all, our book really is not about... We don't talk about Freud as a... We talk about the Freud's way of proceeding very briefly as an example of a non-scientific approach, but then we're really hard on the Freudian notion of repression when
sure.
we talk about
sure.
recovered
and,
memory.
So there was, and I don't want to get us off track. Here is my point, is that would you feel comfortable, and maybe you do, I just have to feel that there's a certain feeling that you must have, being a psychologist and being in that community that still has some very tender, exposed feelings about Freudian theory, right, of completely laying it on the line of just how, like we were, the kind of conversation we were just having here. So what do you do when you feel that balance? And let's take it away from that specific example. What do you feel when you feel that tension between, I need to kind of pull back here a little bit to be tactful from, this is information that needs to come out, and I really can't worry too much about whose feelings are going to be hurt, or if it's a taboo subject, I just need to do some truth-telling.
That's a terrific example, and I have done both in my lifetime because I feel that Freud has done enormous harm. I agree with Sir Peter Medawar, who said psychoanalysis was the greatest intellectual confidence trick of the 20th century. It's a dinosaur in the history of ideas. Now, Over the years, I have written and lectured to different audiences with different goals. And the language I use varies in a way depending on what my goal is. Mm-hmm. In our psychology textbook, we can have Peter Medawar's quote, all right, which we do, along with a quote from Peter Gay saying, my God, this guy was the genius right up there with Copernicus and Galileo, because he, you know, unseated human hubris. And we say to students, you're going to encounter both views of Freud as you travel through your lifetime and your psychology courses. And let's tell you what kind of theory this was to provoke such polarized attitudes, that scientists in psychology no longer have very much to do with Freud for these reasons, but you will encounter a lot of his ideas about repression and denial and this thing and that thing, and you need to know where the evidence is for these. And you need to know what was so compelling about Freudian theory that it lasted for so long. So that is a different goal from, for example, what I have written about the recovered memory movement, for example, for the New York Times Book Review, when I reviewed Courage to Heal and Secret Survivors and all of those books, and said, you know, these books are scientifically illiterate. Period. Uh-huh. They follow Freudian notions that are completely discredited and wrong. They're wrong about repression, they're wrong about memory, and they're wrong about trauma. They wouldn't pass a Psych 101 course. So you can see that the language I use and the passion I bring to the discussion will vary based on the audience. In the case of our book here, Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, we wanted to focus on what happens when some therapists adopting a notion of repression or of children's testimony and so forth don't submit those beliefs to mere evidence and continue perpetuating ideas that can have such devastatingly harmful consequences. And I think we're pretty strong about that. But our goal is not to make people feel stupid for having these beliefs, but to bring readers along. You know, if you're a reader and you have you don't know much about Freud and you have a kind of a vague idea that repression is what we do when we have a traumatic experience, then it's our job as educators to bring all of our readers along in the conversation and not to immediately alienate people who have come from a Freudian tradition or who who believe some of these things but haven't thought about it very seriously.
But isn't that just exactly the kind of sidestepping or balancing act that gets us into trouble whenever we talk about important areas where science and the social or public misunderstanding of science come into play? I mean, if you want to talk about creationism, or if you want to talk about Darwinism, or you want to talk about any topics, stem cell research, that where the science seems to be clearly on one side or another, this balancing act seems to just kind of perpetuate more misunderstanding.
Oh, okay. Let's be really clear about the balancing act. I am absolutely with you on this. There are no two points of view about creationism. Oh, let's do a little creationism here and a little evolution there. No. Okay. On that one, no. And I entirely agree, in fact, with Richard McNally. He's a clinical scientist at Harvard who has written a spectacular book on repression and memory and so forth. And he said, you know, on this recovered memory business, it's not like it's a little bit right here and a little bit wrong there. And, you know, this is not a view where we're going to take two circles and make an oval out of it or something, you know. One side is right and one side is wrong. Either it is possible to repress the memory that your father raped you every day for 16 years, only you forgot it until you went into therapy, or it's not, you know. And I entirely agree with that. I don't think in my career I have been wishy-washy about issues in which the science points clearly to one side. Homosexuality is not a disease. It is not an aberration. It is not a mental illness, even though you can probably still find psychiatrists somewhere who will tell you that it is. So I think it is important for scientists in particular to take public stands on issues in which, in fact, there really is no scientific debate.
Well, I just think, you know, you certainly are unashamed to take a position, and you do a great – I love that. I think that's very refreshing in the book. It's also very challenging because if you do have beliefs at all that differ, I think sometimes it can kind of butt up against that. But I mean, I think that's part of the discourse. I think the problem is that, as the point that you just made, there are so very, very few issues where the science is so clear. I mean, so if we can agree that creationism has no scientific base, and I do completely, I don't think we'd probably agree on whether the fundamental concept of a non-living universe, which we base everything on, is really scientifically proven, and whether or the existence of an afterlife or some intelligent force that might have some factor on our life. I think all those are still open to scientific inquiry, and the problem that I guess I'm going to jump on the other side of the issue is when we are in the mode of standing up and saying, wait, this is truth-telling. This is what the science really says. We have to, I think, as your book cautions, be really, really super open to disconfirming information. And that's just a very hard balancing act to manage.
Oh, you betcha. You betcha. It is. That's the point. I think our goal is to teach people a little bit, a little humor and humility.
Right.
Go a long way in these debates. You know, you asked before what can we do about these things, and I think so often of the issue of family rifts, where one side sees the other as the perpetrator, and they are merely the victim responding to what the perpetrator did, and so forth. And these rifts can then go on and on for years and years, with each side feeling increasingly more righteous, and neither side being able to see what might have been right in the other side's point of view. Well, this is an example of something that people can take away with them if you are willing to put down the burden of being right. Just put it down for a moment
right.
And think about whether the other person might have something to contribute here. And why am I perpetuating this quarrel? Is it important? Do I really need to? What's my motive for this vindictiveness or for keeping this going? Does it really matter? It can be a very liberating thing to say, you know, I was wrong. I harmed my patient. I put the wrong guy away. I insulted my mother, my child, my cousin, and I didn't need to. I could actually go to them and say, I'm so sorry, I was wrong. What can I do to make amends? And when people do that, they find that it is often not as onerous and terrifying and scary and depressing as they anticipated it would be. And, you know, doctors, too, have learned this. You'd think it's such a horrible thing to go to say to a patient, boy, I made a bad mistake. The patient is craving honesty from the doctor, as our country is craving honesty from its leaders, as our spouses are craving honesty from us. You know, if you say to your spouse, boy, honey, you know that fight we've been having all those years about my memory of that thing? You're right, and I was wrong. Is the spouse going to be unhappy with you? I don't think so.
Yeah, but only if you mean it. Only if you mean it.
Only if you mean it.
That's
only
right.
If you mean it. Only if you mean it.
I tell you what, I think that's probably a great place to leave it. I very, very much appreciate, one, the contribution that the book makes. I think it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it to anyone. Again, mistakes were made, but not by me. And thank you, Dr. Tavris, for joining us today on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Tavris for joining me today. If you'd like more information about the show, a link to her book, a link to her website, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, a link to our forum, an email link for me. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.